Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups for the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host a litigation update on SEV Gray, featuring Kayla Toney, counsel at First Liberty Institute. Our moderator today is Professor Eugene Volokh, the Gary T. Schwartz Distinguished Professor of Law Emeritus at UCLA School of Law, and Thomas M. Siebel Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, thank you both for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thank you all. It's great to be with you today. And thank you, Professor Volokh, for joining us. I know free speech is your area of expertise among many, so we're especially glad to have you. So I'll just start off with a quick summary of the case and the opinion, and then we'll turn it over to the professor for his thoughts. So this case arose when two Christian fifth graders were forced to participate in an activity about a book called My Shadow is Pink. This book promotes the idea of gender identity and the idea that a young child can choose their gender and choose to change it. That's something that the author has openly admitted. That's why he wrote the book. And the children were exposed to this book in their buddy class. So this is a mentoring program that pairs older students with younger students. It's a really great idea, a great opportunity for there to be some mentoring, and they call it the buddy program. And so this particular day last May, the students had to read the book together. They watched a video reading aloud the book, sitting next to their kindergarten buddies. And then they had to do an activity involving sidewalk chalk where they went outside and the fifth graders had to draw the shadow of the kindergartner, basically trace their body, and then color it in whatever color the kindergartner chose. And the teachers explicitly said, you have to ask the children what color represents them. And the whole idea of the book and the activity was to choose your own color representing your own gender. And it could be pink, it could be blue, it could be something else. So the fifth grade boys, they're both strong Christians, and they were very uncomfortable and concerned about this activity because they believe that gender is not something that children can change. And they also knew that their little buddies looked up to them. And they felt very strange to be put in a position where they were having to speak a message from the school that was something they didn't agree with. So they went home and told their parents. Parents were concerned. They reached out to the teachers for more information. And then they just asked, you know, in the future, please just let us know if there's going to be activities like this so that we can opt out. And they thought this was a pretty reasonable request because the school already does opt outs for many different things, including from sex ed. And there is a unit on gender identity, and the parents are notified 2 weeks in advance. They have a chance to review the material and they can request an opt out. So the parents thought, you know, this is an easy request. But the school said, no, absolutely not. The only thing we allow opt-outs from is this formal unit on sex ed, and anything else, your child must participate. The activity is mandatory. So eventually the parents then reached out to us and we sued here at First Liberty last September. And in the complaint, we brought a free speech claim based on compelled speech, that the children were forced to speak a message that went against their conscience and their religious beliefs. We also brought free exercise claims, saying that because the school allows opt-outs for a wide variety of different things, they need to treat religion equally and allow opt-outs for religion. And we also brought a parental rights claim because the school refusing to notify the parents and actually sort of concealing this activity from them violated their parental rights. So along with the complaint in the Southern District of California, we also filed for a preliminary injunction because some of the children were still at the school this year and needed that protection to make sure that they wouldn't be forced to speak against their consciences again. The court waited a long time to rule. We just got a ruling on May 12th. And it was a win on the preliminary injunction motion on the compelled speech issue. So the judge, James Lorenz, who is a senior judge, I believe he's a Clinton appointee in the Southern District of California. He didn't reach the free exercise and parental rights claims because he didn't need to in order to rule on our motion. He ruled on the compelled speech ground, and he found that the activity did indeed force the fifth graders to speak a message that went against their beliefs. And he cited a lot of the cases that we had cited in our briefing on compelled speech, which we'll get into here a little bit later with the professor. But it was, it was a strong, very clear ruling. The injunction applies to all elementary school children in this particular district, and it applies to the mentoring program. So if a teacher wants to include a gender identity related lesson in this mentoring program, they must provide at least 3 business days of advance notice to the parents and the opportunity to opt out. And that order will be in place while the rest of the case is ongoing. So I'll pause there. And I'd love to hear from you, Professor Volek. You covered this on your blog, which we really appreciated. And I was curious kind of what caught your attention about the case, what stood out to you about the opinion.
Well, there are several things. One is I would be a pretty poor blogger if I found a case with these facts. Regardless of how legally interesting or not it was, and thought, oh, I'm not going to write about it. Obviously, this is something people, our readers, are very interested in. It touches on important and high-profile debates about education and about the role of schools and about the Constitution. But on top of that, I do think it deals with a very difficult and really unresolved constitutional question. Now, at one level of generality, we know that, generally speaking, the government can't compel speech, can't compel expressions of opinion, can't compel expressions of fact. That the court has told us again and again. But we also know that school is basically nonstop compelled speech, right? A teacher can call on a student and ask some question that may indicate whether the student has done his reading. And if the student says, well, I plead the First Amendment, I have rights not to be compelled to answer your question about algebra. Because remember, compelled speech doctrine applies to factual as well as ideological assertions on uncontroversial topics as well as controversial ones. Well, if the student were to say that, the teacher would say, no, not in this classroom, right? And the teacher might grade the student down if the teacher grades for class participation. Or the teacher may say, look, you know, you did a project. I need you to get up and talk to us about it. And then answer questions from me and from the class. Perfectly normal. But of course, even if the student gets to stay mum the entire school year, which I think would be a mistake pedagogically. But even if that's so, what about homework? You're compelled to write things. That's as much compelled speech as compelled oral remarks. What about the exam? You'd be compelled to answer questions.
Professor Volek, so sorry to interrupt you. Could you just turn up your volume a little bit or maybe move a little closer to the microphone?
Sure.
I think folks are having trouble hearing you.
Thank you for telling me.
We'll compel you to speak a little louder.
Exactly. The little green bar is bouncing up and down quite actively, but maybe it doesn't reflect the actual volume. Is this better? Does this work?
No? That's better on my end. I think that's better for others as well.
Okay,
thank you.
Good. So in any event, there's gotta be room for lots of speech compulsions in school. At the same time, the very first compelled speech case from the Supreme Court came from schools, right? It's the Barnett case, which says you can't be compelled to say the Pledge of Allegiance. Interestingly, the court at the time did not really explain what the boundaries of that are. It was understood that it doesn't extend to ordinary pedagogy, but nobody knew exactly why. So one possible answer is, maybe in the school context, you can be compelled to convey facts, but not to convey ideas. But that can't be right either, right? Because a lot of speech compulsion, especially once you get beyond the early grades, is all about First of all, do you understand the ideas in biology, in history, in whatever literature class you might have? Do you understand those ideas? Can you apply those ideas to particular facts? So it can't just be, it's okay to make you recite like what is the answer to 2 + 7? The school has to have a lot more latitude than that. So one more thing one might say is, well, maybe it's just the difference between controversial and uncontroversial things. But again, lots of things in history class might be controversial. Imagine a student says, my parents are good Marxists, and they believe the Marxist version of American history. That's very different from what you're teaching here. So you can't give me homework on the old one, or at least you have to accept the Marxist answer, even if you folks think it's wrong. And more to the point, even if it differs from what the reading materials in this class provide. Likewise, on the exam, you have to grade my exam differently. Probably a teacher would give, especially in high school, let's say, give students somewhat more latitude in answering certain in-class questions, in part because that's good teaching, right? At that point, you don't want the students just to say, well, the book says the following, quote, end quote. Rather, you want them to come up with interesting ideas, maybe even original ideas, and maybe you'll grade them for kind of the internal consistency, even if you disagree with them in some measure. But for some things, like on exams, you may need them to be able to accurately report what the ideas that they were taught were, even if they find them controversial. So I'll give you one other example, theater class. If you have students who are doing a play, to be sure, I think at some point it becomes optional if you don't really want everybody to have to be in the play. But I think early grades, where you don't expect great acting, but you just want to introduce people to theater, there might be maybe theater class where somebody has to read some line and somebody says, well, I don't like this line. Or even I think this line contains words that are blasphemous. They're really blasphemous in the view of the public generally, probably the school wouldn't assign them. But somebody may have idiosyncratic perceptions, or I just think these lines are false and evil. Well, yeah, you're playing an evil character. Well, I refuse. Again, in theater class, you have to have some flexibility to do that. There's actually a case called Axe and Flynn. I think it's actually university level, where the compulsion is a little different, although still present, where the court says, at least as the free speech issue, in theater class, you can be required to read your lines. You can even be required to convey them in ways that sound sincere, even though, of course, by definition, in theater class, they're not sincere. The trick is to sound sincere. So what to do? So I think what's going on in your case, and I think the reason why I think the result was probably correct, but highly unusual, is the nature of this program, where a fifth grader isn't just being asked to read something for class, or even read out loud something just as kind of an assignment to read things out loud, or to answer questions about something that might be controversial. So they're asked to read it to somebody else, and to somebody else who's much younger, and therefore likely to see this person as kind of, see the fifth grader as authoritative in a certain sense, and likely to perceive the fifth grader as actually being sincere about this. I think once you get into higher grades, everybody understands, this is just an assignment. I don't necessarily endorse this. In fact, there's no reason at all to think I endorse this. But when it's a very young child perceiving what an older child is saying, it does, I think, look to the young child like the older child really means it, that the older child is really conveying something, not just like in a homework, or in an essay. You understand that this is maybe in your voice, but this is just an assignment. To the younger child, may not seem that way. And therefore, to the older child can reasonably worry that he's being put in a position where he is actually being asked to proselytize a particular idea. Now, actually, it's an interesting question how this fits with Barnett, because the one thing that was clear in Barnett is it was totally mandated. The words were totally mandated. Nobody would perceive anybody as actually endorsing it, actually pledging that. Pledges only work if they're voluntary. But maybe there is also something about the cultural context of a pledge, that it isn't just I am reciting a particular document. It's in the words of I pledge, even if coerced, it might likewise at least appear to the speaker as if they're being asked to fully endorse this, not just to report it for purposes of class, but fully endorse this. So I think for that reason, I think the result is correct. I just think it can't be simply, well, your compelling speech, and I think you probably agree. I mean, I think the judge would probably agree as well, but it can't just be as simple as this is speech that is being compelled, therefore it is compelled speech under the compelled speech doctrine, therefore it's presumptively unconstitutional, therefore it must pass strict scrutiny. It's the very peculiar nature of the compulsion here, which makes it seem to the speaker, because of his very plausible perception of how it seems to the listener, makes it seem like this is actually him endorsing it, him actually conveying it in his own voice. I mean that figuratively, conveying it as his own message. And that's the compulsion that's impermissible, even while lots of other compulsions in the school context are just fine. That's my take on that.
Yes.
I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Sure. That's fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing. I think, yeah, it's a very interesting question, kind of what is the limiting principle here and why did this opinion turn out how it did? And I think there's a few different things going on in addition to what you mentioned. The fact that religious beliefs are at stake here, I think, played into the court's analysis. He said, you know, plaintiffs contend they were compelled to affirm a message they disagree with and which is contrary to his religious beliefs. So I think it's not so much a test of whether something is controversial, because that's very subjective, but it's whether something directly infringes or conflicts with the child's religious beliefs. And I think that's where we see the parallel with Barnett, because it was the Jehovah's Witness elementary school children who believed they could only pledge to God. They're not allowed to swear oaths. They're not allowed to say the pledge. They're not allowed to salute the flag. And so that was a unique thing that really conflicted with their own beliefs. And the interesting thing there too is the action element. And I think that's part of this as well. So the activity that our clients had to participate in, it wasn't just passively listening to a book or reading a book even. It was this action of chalking the shadow on the ground. And courts have held that expressive activity outside of just kind of traditional speech using words can also, bring in the First Amendment concerns. So from 303 Creative, all manner of speech from pictures, films, paintings, drawings, and engravings to oral utterance and the printed word qualify for the First Amendment's protections. So the court said our client's tracing of his buddy's shadow on the ground was an expressive act protected by the First Amendment. And then the court also went into acts of expressive association. So we had cited in our briefing the Boy Scouts case, the Hurley case, which was about a parade, the Janus case, which is about compelled speech in the union context. And so the court kind of pulled from all these different contexts and said, you know, it's similar here where it's the spoken word, it's the expressive act. And it's, I think, that conflict with the child's religious beliefs and conscience. And then I'm glad you mentioned the age as well of the students, because I do think that played into the court's decision. They actually cited Edwards v. Aguillard, which is a Establishment Clause case, saying that elementary school students are impressionable due to their emulation of teachers as role models and susceptibility to peer pressure. And I think that was very much in play here. If you ask our fifth grade client, he was worried about getting in trouble. Most fifth grade boys, you know, make noise during class and they know, you know, they can get in trouble for that. And so he didn't want to raise his hand and object in the moment. And interestingly, in their briefing, the school district sort of faulted him for that and said, well, clearly it didn't seem objectionable at the time because he didn't say anything. But the court really called them on that and said, you know, he didn't want to get in trouble. And of course, it's a mandatory class. The district conceded that in their briefing, that this was a mandatory activity. He had no option, that they didn't ask the children if they wanted to do the activity. Typically in school, you just have to do it, or else you do get in trouble. And so I think it's interesting that the court here drew on the elementary school context, and its order applies to elementary school students. And I think that's certainly important, especially when it comes to those ideas about gender identity, because certainly as students get older, they're going to be exposed to lots of different ideas, especially in public school. Parents know that. That's part of growing up, of being in our society. But when they're so young, to have ideas of sexuality or gender or, sexual relationships even presented to them before their parents are able to do it themselves, or, before the children are really mentally and psychologically ready to grapple with those concepts, I do think that that makes a difference. And that was something I noticed as well in the Mahmoud v. Taylor case, which we're all eagerly awaiting that opinion to come down here sometime soon. But at oral argument, the judges really seemed to zero in on the fact that it was elementary school students that weren't really ready to be having these conversations outside the context of their parents and their home about really sensitive topics that aren't necessarily appropriate for such a young age. So
I very much appreciate your remarks. Let me mention one thing I agree with and another thing that I don't quite agree with. The freedom of speech and freedom from compelled speech applies to symbolic expression as well as to verbal expression. That is not a new principle. The very first Supreme Court case to strike down a speech restriction on free expression grounds, Stromberg v. California in May of 1931, involved symbolic expression. It involved a ban on the display of a red flag as a symbol of opposition to organized government. Of course, we know the very first compelled speech case 12 years later, Barnett, also involved symbolic expression as well as verbal expression. I did some research and I found that throughout American history, down to the framing and before, it was generally understood that symbolic expression, verbal expression, and pictorial expression are identical for freedom of expression principles. I don't want to say First Amendment because a lot of the early cases involved state constitutional provisions, because that, of course, was most in play there. And likewise, just under traditional libel law that applied to restrictions on speech, you can be prosecuted or sued for libel for symbolic expression that is libelous as well. So occasionally you hear people say, well, it's freedom of speech, literally means only speech. That has not been the rule throughout American history, tradition, and precedent. So yes, I do think that tracing the shadow very much covered by the First Amendment, it is symbolic expression. Of course, there are interesting questions like, where you draw the line between what is symbolic expression and what is not. The court has spoken to that. But in this context, it's quite clear that this is. But the thing I don't quite agree with is the focus on the religious nature of the speech. Because after all, this decision was under the free speech clause. So there is a free exercise challenge, but the decision was under the free speech clause. Free speech is enjoyed by everyone, religious or otherwise. And freedom from compelled speech is enjoyed by everyone. And in fact, if you look at Barnett came 3 years after Gobitis, which rejected a free exercise challenge to the pledge. And Barnett accepted a free speech challenge to the pledge. Now, part of it is that the court may have just, enough justices may have changed their views in the time. But actually, Barnett expressly deals with this question of religious motivation of the children. And it says, nor does the issue as we see it turn on one's possession of particular religious views or the sincerity with which they are held. While religion supplies a police motive, many citizens who do not share these religious views hold such a compulsory right to infringe constitutional liberty of the individual. It is not necessary to inquire whether nonconformist beliefs will exempt from the duty. In other words, we don't need to reach again the religious exemption question unless we first find power to make the salute a legal duty. And they said the government doesn't have the power because of the free speech clause, which applies regardless of religious beliefs. One consequence of this is that if indeed a compelled speech right is recognized here, it would have to be recognized equally as to everybody, whether they have religious beliefs or not. Likewise, if it's recognized here, it would have to be recognized equally, regardless of the subject matter, right? Because whatever, as a practical matter, maybe the views of parents with regard to sexual matters, let's say sexual matters to cover both sexual orientation and gender identity and sexual activity and such. Parents may view sexual matters very different from teaching history or very different from teaching physics, but the First Amendment does not view them as different. There is no, I mean, setting aside actual pornography or material that's obscene as to minors, the First Amendment does not distinguish between compelled speech that has to do with gender identity and compelled speech that has to do with American history. So that's why I think the scope of the principle here is even broader than the scope of the principle in Mahmoud v. Knight, potentially. In Mahmoud v. Knight, the question is whether there's a constitutional right to opt out for specifically for religious objections. And even though most Americans are religious, many of those religions don't really tell you much about what you should or should not study in school. But compelled speech objections, everybody has right to be free from compelled speech. So I think as a result, because of the possible breadth of the compelled speech claim, this decision has to be understood as quite narrow in its coverage. It gives you very deep, maybe I shouldn't say breadth, depth of the claim. It applies really deep to everybody who has any sort of objection, but therefore it can only apply narrowly to situations where people are compelled to say things in a way that reasonably comes across, at least to some listeners, as reflecting their beliefs and not just reflecting the nature of an exercise. So again, I think it's the right result here, and a result that can apply even to other topics and even to parents who have non-religious objections. But again, it is tied to the very particular nature of the speaker and of the audience and of the exercise here, I think.
Right. That's fascinating. I do agree with you, unfortunately, for the purposes of a friendly FedSac debate. But I'm so glad you brought that out. And that does answer one of our questions from the audience here is, you know, can individuals opposing compelled speech but not asserting a religious basis have hope for relief? And the answer is yes, absolutely. And a lot of the cases that the court cited here don't necessarily relate directly to religion. A lot of them are just, you know, they didn't want to make the speech. They didn't want to include the group in the parade. Green v. Miss America, they didn't want to include women who identify or men who identified as women. And it wasn't necessarily tied to religion. It was just kind of, this isn't the purpose of the event that we have. And so yes, I do think there's absolutely protection here. And that's helpful in this context because we've worked with so many parents across the US who have said, we're concerned about what our children are learning in school. We're not necessarily religious. Our concern doesn't necessarily relate to our religious beliefs. We just think they're too young, or we want to be the ones to talk to them about these matters before they're outside of our home. And we've heard that so consistently, but legally the protections are not as strong under parental rights jurisprudence, just because a lot of it is based on substantive due process. And that's controversial, especially with conservative judges. And so we're hoping to see some light, some improvement there, but it is just a harder claim to make based on parental rights. But I think when you look at the students themselves and you focus on what the students believe and what the students are being forced to affirm or teach or express, kind of as their own view, that's really helpful because it does provide, you know, a broader potential for protection. Again, as you said, in specific contexts. So I'm curious here if we can play a little bit of hypotheticals. What are some other contexts, Professor Volek, where you think compelled speech would happen in school in a way that could be protected under this type of a ruling?
So I think there are two possible answers. One answer is analytical, and the other is kind of impressionistic, but human beings operate on both levels. So both, I think, are important. So analytically, I think one might try to distinguish situations where something is, people don't say these words, but where the subtext is, that is understood is, given the rules of the class, or given the understanding of this assignment, here's the answer. Here's the answer that the book gives. You know, if on a test, I think, nobody thinks a test is a measure of your deep, sincere beliefs. The test is a measure of how well did you learn the material that you were taught. You don't have to agree with it. You just have to provide it. Some people pejoratively say you just have to regurgitate. Well, you know, some on some matters, maybe. But on other matters, it may be that you need to kind of thoughtfully apply the principles you were taught. But it's understood. It's all about measuring what you were taught. Another example is theater. Again, you don't have to say the words, but it's clear that what you are saying is not what you believe, it's what your character believes. Who knows? I wonder, you can imagine a world where Hollywood are the good actors and the evil actors. Evil actors really are bad people. That's why they're so good at playing the bad guys. I have to think that's not so. I'd like to think they're folks who are also good actors. And to be a good actor, you have to inhabit a role. And nobody ascribes to you, or at least nobody should ascribe to you, endorsement of the role. On the other side are things like that are framed in terms that are generally understood as personal belief, like I pledge, that is a personal, those are the words of a personal promise, even when it's coerced. Or it is said to small children who will perceive the speaker as endorsing this. Or another example is it in a context where it's generally understood that the person, that other people are speaking for themselves. So for example, occasionally you hear about schools pressuring students or even requiring students to show up at some political rally or to write a letter to a legislator. Those are media where the social context is generally one of belief on the part of the author or the participant. So even if the student may know, oh, I'm just being compelled to do this, the student may worry, look, the reader or the observer might perceive this as if it's my view. And then the impressionistic point, I think the closer things are to traditional curriculum, to traditional assignments and traditional ways of testing on those assignments and traditional ways of promoting in-class conversations, the more I think judges are going to say, look, this is just what a public school is all about. So again, tests, homework, questions about the material, theatrical productions within the school seems to me fit within this tradition. And partly they may be defended because judges are interested in tradition, both as a doctrinal matter and a professional matter. But also the tradition signals to listeners that this is not the person's own view. On the other hand, once you get to something like a pledge, which I do think that my guess is even in 1943 it was understood, this is not curriculum. This isn't just civics class. This isn't just, look, we want you to memorize the first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence because it's a really important document and we want you to be able to recite it. That would be a lot more like traditional curriculum. A pledge, not so much. Likewise with this. That's my tentative sense of how these lines probably will end up and should end up being drawn. Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's fascinating. And I think, too, it's significant as we've seen education shift away from a more traditional model, as you described, to a more interactive experience. I'm thinking of social emotional learning, which is a huge element now of what schools are teaching, especially in the younger grades. And a lot of that involves activities and participation, and it's all designed for the child to, you know, be engaged and to bring their whole self into the activity. And so I think those things do pose a little bit more of a risk here that there would be compelled speech. I'm thinking of something like a role play. I spoke with a student who had to role play coming out as a lesbian in her class, and that was just not something she was comfortable with because of her religious beliefs, but also just her personal views. So she walked out of her class and she got in trouble for that. And I think, you know, that's an example. Right. Another one I'm thinking of, the Israel-Palestine conflict. What if a Jewish student has to participate in a rally about free Palestine? Right. That sort of thing is happening a lot in Philadelphia public schools right now, where there's a very strong pro-Palestinian emphasis. And the teachers that are pushing it have actually said, we don't want both sides of this to be taught, because that is giving in to the colonizers or the Zionists, which is the slur that they use. And so they say, there's only one view here. You have to be an activist. You have to be a social justice warrior, you know, on this particular issue. And I think that push in education probably does raise more concerns. And so we will probably see more of these cases popping up. Again, not the traditional context that you mentioned, where you take a test or you're doing a debate and you're assigned a position and that's just what you argue, you know, and you don't necessarily need to agree with it or not. But I think it's those, you know, rallies, assemblies, celebrations, maybe political agendas, a pledge about current political issues. I think that's where we see a lot of these heading.
Right. Well, certainly a pledge, you know, you want to talk precedents. If you forget the pledge, hard to resist Barnett there. But yes, I do think that if you require someone to attend a political rally, that is unconstitutional, speech compulsion, participate in. I would go further, and I would say that even if they say, look, you know, we want you to attend a political rally, it doesn't matter which side, but we want you to participate in a political rally because we want to promote engaged citizenship. I think even there you should be able to say, well, no, that's not the way I want to speak. Or maybe one day I will want to participate in a political rally, but it should be when I choose, when I find there's something I feel strongly enough to rally about. So I'm not even sure that viewpoint neutrality should save that kind of compulsion. On the other hand, so role play is a little complicated. Maybe because this is relatively new, and I just don't know exactly how it plays out. But what's not new, certainly not new for us as former law students or as law school teachers, is, well, argue the other side. If you were the lawyer for the other side, what would you say? Now, that's at law school, where, again, the speech compulsion is complicated. You are voluntarily there, although once you're there and put in all the money, now you have to do certain things in order to graduate. But imagine that somebody says, you know, we want to spread the Socratic method we want to teach law in high school kind of the way it's taught in law school. And you need to make the best argument you can for a particular position. You don't agree with that position? No problem. I'll even note it for you, for the benefit of the class. The speaker does not agree with this position. But I want you to be able to make that argument, because you can't even understand your own arguments well, unless you can make the best argument for the other side. Or doesn't have to be law. I mean, let's say you're teaching about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and somebody says, you know, I'm militantly on the side of the Palestinians or militantly on the side of Israel. You say, well, how do you think the people on the other side feel? I refuse to tell you, because I don't want to for a moment inhabit that evil worldview. But how can we understand the Israeli-Palestinian conflict unless we understand the way both sides feel? Now, so I think that kind of compulsion probably would be permissible. Now, one possible answer is, but it has to be viewpoint neutral. It has to be balanced. I think as a matter of good educational policy, it definitely has to be balanced. But as a general matter, K through 12 education does not need to be ideologically balanced. And by the way, there's nothing new, of course, about lack of ideological balance. I think historically, my guess is, you know, teachers were expected to teach a particular received version of American history, and America was in the right, and the other folks were in the wrong. And maybe depending on the state, for the Civil War, maybe there was a different view about who was America really, and who was the other folks who were in the wrong. Maybe, but in general, probably, even as to the Civil War, but certainly as to other matters, World War II, we were right, Nazis were in the wrong. Cold War, we were in the right, communists were in the wrong. Maybe in the past, even the Indians were in the wrong. Maybe today it's taught differently. But schools have always been places for inculcating values and for teaching one would hope, not completely narrow-mindedly, but in a way that that does prefer certain viewpoints over other viewpoints. So you might say, well, that's true as to the teaching, but can't be true as to any kind of speech compulsion exercises. So the kind of what's the best argument on the other side exercise has to be done in a viewpoint-neutral way. Maybe, although then it becomes kind of very, very weirdly gerrymandered doctrine there. So I'm inclined to say that that indeed any attendance at things that are generally identifiable as political rallies or political activism, any compulsion is unconstitutional, even in K-12 school. But compulsion just to sort of see what's the other side's argument. If you were living on the West Bank or in Gaza, how do you think you would feel? Now, that's actually an important part of education, I think.
Right, absolutely. And that's where teachers have an important role to teach both sides and to welcome that instead of having this view that, you know, I, as the teacher, I'm an activist and I only want one view to be seen, which I think is a lot of what we're seeing. So speaking of teachers, though, I think you touched.
So let me just say, I agree with you very much. That's what teachers should generally do. I just don't think, and I'm not sure whether you do, but I don't think that's a legally enforceable rule. The requirement that teachers be open-minded and balanced in these kinds of things. That, I think, the constraint, and it has to be a political constraint, that parents can push back, parents can show up at school board meetings, parents can vote out the school board, parents can use recall. As I understand it, recalls are in states where they're available, can actually be pretty powerful tools for disciplining government officials, that even officials who withstand the recall don't want to see another attempt happen at it. But I don't think there's a legally enforceable, judicially enforceable, under the Constitution mandate that the teachers be fair-minded.
What do you think about viewpoint discrimination, though, as a matter of government speech? So, for example, under the Establishment Clause, as Justice Sotomayor reminded us yesterday in her opinion in Catholic Charities, the government cannot pick winners and losers between religions. And so if a teacher who's speaking as a government spokesperson in the classroom is denigrating one religion and maybe exalting another in a situation such as, you know, Israel and Palestine potentially, or in another situation, wouldn't that transgress a requirement of viewpoint neutrality in terms of
There is no requirement of viewpoint neutrality as to government speech, and there cannot be such a requirement, I think. I think the Establishment Clause case law works, again, provides strong protection only because it's so limited to basically about religions or about purely theological matters. The reason I say that can't be is, look, the government can put out ads that say, Uncle Sam wants you to join the army. If somebody says, well, I would like you to spend equal amount of time saying, Uncle Sam wants you to be a conscientious objector. The government doesn't have to do that. And even though that's a controversial moral question, in which, in fact, some religions take one particular view. Now, the government can't say Quakerism is evil, probably, at least under existing Establishment Clause doctrine. That is targeting a religion for condemnation. That's, again, but a very peculiar religion-specific rule. Likewise, the government can teach tolerance is good, bigotry is bad. We can debate a lot about what should be called one or the other, but that has to be something that the government doesn't need to be neutral on. Likewise, when it was teaching World War II, I don't think it has to say, well, you know, the Nazis had some interesting ideas. You know, if you were a good German in 1939, you'd probably think it would be a very good idea to invade Poland. I suppose one could say that in the process of saying how do people come come to such awful belief systems, but they don't have to be even-handed. Likewise, during the Cold War, obviously there were some people who were pro-communist, pro-Soviet, and they sent their kids to school. In the school, they said Soviet Union is an evil empire. To be sure, that's a 1980s phrase, but there were versions of that before. And we're in the right. I think that is quite correct. But in any event, the government didn't have to teach even-handedly on the question of whether democracy and capitalism is better than communism. Just to give an example from Rust v. Sullivan, a case in which the court said the government can fund essentially speech about contraception, but not speech about abortion. One of the lines was, you can have a national endowment for democracy without a national endowment for communism. I think that's got to be right. And again, the constraints on narrow-mindedness or excessive indoctrination by the government have to be political and not judicial.
So here's a question from our audience, but also from me. What if the teacher has religious beliefs or just a personal view that they're not comfortable teaching "My Shadow is Pink"? And what if it's, you know, part of the buddy program for that day that they're supposed to teach and the teacher wants to opt out? What then?
That is a great question. I think it's somewhat complicated because there are two bodies of law relevant here. Three bodies. One is free exercise law, potentially. One is free speech law. And one is Title VII. Let's begin with free speech. A teacher does not have the right to say, "I want to not teach this and teach that instead." They are teaching on behalf of the government. They are speaking on behalf of the government. The government can say, "Here's what you should say." By the way, there's some controversy about that with regard to university professors at public law schools, which I was until I retired from classroom teaching. And some courts had said, and others not so much, that there is this autonomy of the professor, a university professor. I'm not sure this sort of special rights for university professors are right. I'm not sure they're wrong either. They're plausible arguments you can make, but they've never been adapted to other employees, including K-12 teachers. So no free speech claim. What about free exercise claim? It was actually, before we get to free exercise, let's talk about Title VII. Title VII requires that all employers, public or private, have to accommodate religious objections, including when it's part of a person's job, like says, "I don't want to show up to work on Saturday," or not, "I don't want to, but God tells me not to show up to work on Saturday. Yes, it creates an undue hardship. And what defines an undue hardship has changed very recently. It used to be, perhaps incorrectly, that the court said undue hardship is essentially anything more than a de minimis expense. Now the court says, no, it's got to be really pretty, very substantial hardship, including substantial expense. But I do think that if the school says, "We want to teach American history a particular way, or even we want to teach English through particular books, because we think that those books really give people a better understanding of human psychology," because that's a lot of what English classes are, not just reading and writing, but understanding like what great novels teach us about the way humans live and what we are like, what the meaning of life is, and such. So if so imagine that the school says, "Look, we need to do this. You say you object to this book, so you're going to be you have to be unavailable for 4 days while the book is taught. You can't grade presumably the homework you say on this. You can't grade essays that discuss this." So now we have to bring in a substitute teacher that's both more expensive but also disruptive to the students, because this teacher may not know exactly kind of the way the primary class is taught. I think most of us, our view was, you know, classes taught by a sub are not as effective as classes that are taught by the student, but mostly by the main teacher. So I think it may be that it's an undue hardship to require the school to essentially either change the curriculum, which they don't want to do, or provide a substitute that covers for the teacher for several days. Maybe different if it's just for one day for some optional exercise, and it's the sort of thing that it's pretty normal to have a sub 3 or 4 days during the semester. Maybe it's a case by case decision making process. So then the question is, what about free exercise? Imagine Employment Division versus Smith is reversed, or imagine you're in a state that has a RFRA, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or that a state that has read its state constitution as following the Sherbert Yoder model of compelled religious exemptions. Do you really, do teachers really get an exemption unless denying it is necessary to serve a compelling government interest? I mean, if teachers do, then anybody else does too. Like somebody says, you know, I'm a postal worker and I just don't want to deliver some material that I think is blasphemous, so you have to hire someone else to deliver it on my route. Is the test really strict scrutiny? I mean, if you look at the text of RFRAs, that's what it sounds like. But we know that when the government is acting as an employer and it's free speech that's the issue, the government has a lot more authority over employees' speech than the government as sovereign does over ordinary citizens. Likewise, when we're talking, I think, about free exercise clause, if the court does indeed reverse Smith, I hope the court will say, as with free speech, free exercise may have different rules where the government is acting in different roles. And strict scrutiny might not be the general rule. Maybe the rule is actually something much more like Title VII, where the government doesn't have to show a compelling interest or a damage to a compelling interest. It just has to show undue hardship. Maybe. We'll see.
An interesting case here, which I think touches on a lot of what you mentioned, Professor, is Kennedy versus Bremerton. This was a First Liberty case at the Supreme Court where the court held 6-3 that Coach Kennedy, who was a government employee as a football coach, had both free speech and free exercise rights, and he could pray on the football field as long as it was not in a manner that was coercive to other students. And the court there, Justice Gorsuch, really explained it well, that the free exercise clause and the free speech clause work together to provide what he called double protection, overlapping protection for people of faith. And so that principle, I think, is really helpful here, that, you know, when a teacher is asked to speak something that goes against their faith, there is that core protection. And I think an example we saw in a difficult context is in the Mirabelli versus Olson case. This is another Southern District of California case. And some teachers, because of their Catholic faith, they objected to the school's pronoun policy, which forced them to use preferred pronouns that conflict with biology in accordance with students' preferred gender identity, and also to conceal gender transitions from parents. And the teachers brought a Title VII claim and free exercise, I believe, saying that they couldn't in good conscience lie to parents that went against their faith, and also to speak names or pronouns that went against their religious beliefs was also a problem. And they won. The teachers were actually reinstated. And the court held that teachers, even public school teachers, cannot be forced to directly violate their own religious beliefs, especially in a situation where there were plenty of alternatives. There were lots of ways of accommodating. And the school didn't bother to, you know, explore any of those. It just went ahead and fired the teachers. So I think that's an interesting one. And I think you're absolutely right that the Title VII standard comes into play as well. And thankfully, under the Supreme Court's unanimous opinion in Graff versus DeJoy, as you mentioned, the standard now is much higher, that employers would have to show an actual substantial increased cost would result from accommodating. And in order to show that, they have to actually try to accommodate, or at least come up with a cost of, you know, is it really just this one lesson that the teacher objects to? Or is it just, you know, the use of a certain name or pronoun, or following a certain policy regarding parental notification? Maybe a sub's not even needed. The teacher just needs a workaround. And I think often those workarounds are possible, and the burden is on the employer to make the good faith effort to actually accommodate instead of just, you know, denying the request out of hand.
Well, so that's certainly true about Title VII. Some cases I think are pretty easy. Kennedy is an example. One of the things the court stressed was that Kennedy was essentially speaking on his own time, in that this wasn't in the middle of the game, right? If he had said, you know, as a means of my own self-expression, while I'm out there kind of coaching in the middle of the game, I am going to also carry a banner saying Jesus is Lord, I think people would say, well, wait a minute, you know, here you're speaking on behalf of the school. You're speaking as part of your job. The school can tell you what to say and what not to say there. Now, when you're on break, and one of the things the court stressed is during, this was after the game was over, after the teams were dismissed, people could take phone calls, people can chat with each other. You could also go out there and pray, including on the 50-yard line, but not, I think, as part of your job. Another way of thinking about it, just to build on some of the examples we had, imagine somebody says, you know, and I'm not saying this is the Muslim view, but all it takes is one person's view, right, under religious exemption law. And it doesn't have to be the view, the established view of the religion. Says, you know, as a Muslim, I believe it is my duty to speak up whenever possible on behalf of other Muslims. And I think what's happening in Gaza is a genocide. And I think Israel is not a legitimate country. So when I teach this this subject, instead of calling it Israel, I'm going to call it the Jewish state. And instead of describing the war in Gaza, I'm going to call it the Jewish genocide of innocent Muslims in Gaza. And I have a religious freedom right to do that. I think I do that not in a tweet, do that while teaching my class. I think the answer is no, you don't, because it would be an undue hardship for us to accommodate this request. And the reason it would be an undue hardship is, as a school, we are entitled to control how something is taught. Now, is there a compelling interest in our teaching this subject in a particular way? Not sure it's compelling. It's not like people will die if we teach it some other way. It's not like it'll interfere with national security or whatever else. But in our democratic system, the curriculum is set not by individual teachers, or at least should be set, but not by individual teachers, but by the representatives of the people. And if a teacher wants to essentially hijack the class discussion to basically proselytize her own views, whether those views are religiously motivated or not, they're not entitled to do that. It would be an undue hardship, even if it costs us zero extra dollars. It would be an undue hardship in the damage to our control, democratic control of the school curriculum, to basically allow the teacher to do this. So it doesn't mean that teachers should own Muslims. Again, if the teacher says, you know, you may have a no beard policy, but I'm a Muslim and I need to wear a beard, or I'm a Jew and I need to wear an Orthodox Jew, or then I think the burden is very low on the government. But I don't think that the teachers would have broad rights to decide what to teach and what not to teach in their classrooms, even under Title VII or the Free Exercise Clause.
Okay, fascinating. I realize we're almost at an hour here and I want to respect everyone's time. So I'm just going to hit quickly a couple of the last questions in the chat and then we'll wrap us up. We have a question on, now that the injunction in this case has been granted, what's next? And we will continue fighting. So we are not sure yet whether the school district is going to appeal this ruling to the Ninth Circuit. We'll find that out next week. If they don't appeal, we will start discovery and learn a lot more about sort of the agenda that this school district does have in teaching gender identity. We already know that the teachers who decided to do this activity texted with each other the night before and said, you know, let's encourage some sweet little ones to fly toward their shadow. So we know that there was an act of intention on behalf of the teachers to push this view that someone could change their gender identity. But it'll be interesting during discovery to see that come out. So definitely stay tuned on the further developments in that case. We'll be continuing to fight. And then just one other question really quick about opt-outs. I do think that we might start seeing more opt-out provisions and notice requirements adopted as a precaution to avoid litigation. If I were advising a school district right now, regardless of the ideology going on, I would certainly encourage them to provide more parental notice and more opt-out opportunities, even just to mitigate risk of lawsuits on these controversial issues. I think it's an easy thing to do. It's relatively workable because most schools provide opt-outs for all sorts of things, from, you know, standardized testing to gym class. They provide personalized school educational plans for students with disabilities. You know, education is getting more and more personal and more tailored to the individual needs of the student. And so as that happens, I think opt-outs are really an easy way for schools to facilitate different viewpoints and avoid, you know, potential litigation. And then again, stay tuned for the Mahmood decision. I think that will be really significant in terms of whether opt-outs are required for religious reasons in particular. So I think we'll wrap up there. Thank you all so much for your time. Thank you, Professor Volek, for sharing your insights. That was an excellent discussion, and I hope everyone enjoyed it. Thank you, Marco, for hosting.
Yes, thank you, everyone, and thank you for inviting me. I had a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.